When we left off last time, we were looking at Genesis chapter 19, and we saw a very unpleasant thing happening there in Genesis chapter 19, didn't we? We saw the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, this map shows where, well, I think they were in one place, some other people think they were in another place, but this map shows Sodom and Gomorrah over here. You see that right there? Sodom, and there's a Gomorrah right there. But you see that question mark after both of those? That's because they don't know for sure exactly where those cities are. They can't find them through excavation. I think they're underneath that water right there. Because the Dead Sea here, from here down to here, like 1,500 feet deep. And that last little part down there at the bottom, that's only like 10 or 15 feet deep. So it was formed at a different time, it looks like. And I think what happened is that when God burned these cities to ashes, which Peter tells us he did, that was the lesson of Sodom and Gomorrah. Peter tells us in 2 Peter 2:6, he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what's going to happen to the ungodly. So after he burned them to ashes, I think he buried them underwater as well. And that little part down there is what buried them in that valley. But that's my opinion. But since they can't find them, I think that's probably what happened. And that sort of completed the judgment on those two cities, as Peter tells us, is an example of the destruction that awaits the ungodly. Now, most of the world doesn't pay attention to that example. They're ignoring it. But that doesn't make it any less true, does it? And so that we saw some of that detail of how that took place. And in the very last of chapter 19, we saw sort of the epitaph of Lot's life. It didn't end very well for him, did it? He ends up living in a cave down in this region, having incestuous relationships with his two daughters. And they formed the nations of Moab and Ammon. The Ammonites and the Moabites came from Lot and his daughters as a result of this incestuous relationship that he had with them, living down in that region following the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And unfortunately, his testimony in the scriptures is not a good one, and his life ended up in a very unpleasant way. The consequences of choosing what the world has to offer instead of what God had to offer, and he went and lived in a place that ultimately then was destroyed. And so that kind of concluded that section in chapter 19. Where we want to go on here this morning is in chapter 20. Now, when God and the two angels came down to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, they stopped off at Abraham's house along the way. Remember that? He ran out and greeted them and fixed them he said something like a piece of bread or something like that. It was a feast that he put in front of them. And they talked and visited a little bit. And God told Abraham, this would be the pre-incarnate Christ, I think, actually spoke to him, and said to him in chapter 18, verses 10 and 14, that in about another year, he's going to come back, and Sarah was going to have a son. Verse 10 of chapter 18, I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. That's verse 10. Verse 14, is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. Isaac's death was at an appointed time. The Lord's death was, his birth, and so was his death for that matter, was at an appointed time. It's called the fullness of time in Scripture that the Lord came. I think it's probably a reference to the state of the Roman Empire and the various things there that facilitated Christianity. But the type of Christ, Isaac, and Christ himself, both were born at an appointed time, a time that God had set for these things to take place. And the appointed time for Isaac was going to be about a year from the visit that Abraham and the pre-incarnate Christ were having there. Okay? So they knew that a year from that date, Isaac was going to be born. Now, can you subtract 9 from 12? Sure you can. Sarah is going to have to conceive in the next 3 months, isn't she, from that date? because Isaac's going to be born a year from then. She has to conceive in about 3 months from that visit. Now, if you were Abraham and you'd been waiting for 25 years for your son to be born that had been promised to you, and the angel from God said, well, by little simple arithmetic, in about 3 months she's going to conceive a child, what would you have done in regards to Sarah and in regards to her safety and to and her exposure to other men for that 3 month interval? Wouldn't you have put a fence around her? Wouldn't you have been particularly careful not to let her get in any kind of a position that might compromise her physical well-being and corrupt her by some other man, when you know that in that 3 month window she has to conceive? So wouldn't you have stayed put, been very careful where you went, guarded her, watched over her, and been sort of extra careful? Well, let's see what Abraham did. That's what I would have done, but hey, that's just me. Let's see what Abraham did. Verse 1 of chapter 20. Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. Then he sojourned in Gerar. Now what he's done here is he's gone from where he was living, which is up here around Hebron and Mamre. He's come down over to here. And if you notice, who lives in that area? Them nasty Philistines, they live in that area. There were actually five cities that formed the Philistine Empire. You can see three or four of them running through there. This is all their territory right here. Are they particularly God-fearing people? No. Would you expect you and your entourage, your family, to be particularly safe in the midst of the Philistines if you were Abraham? No. Why did he leave where he was and wander over to there? What prompted him at this particular time, when it is especially important that Sarah be kept physically safe? Why would he wander over into a midst of a people that don't fear God, may not have the same respect for a family relationship that Abraham has, and go live there at this particular time? I wonder. And not only do I wonder about that, but I really wonder about what happens next. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." Now stop me if you've heard this before. 25 years ago, they used the same ruse, and they've got this standing agreement between Abraham and Sarah that anywhere we go, if we're amongst godless peoples, I'm going to tell them you're my sister so they don't kill me to take you. And Sarah bought into that plan for some strange reason. So they pull this same thing again that they did 25 years ago down in Egypt. They act like she's his sister, which is a technicality. She actually was a half-sister. So there is a technicality there, but that ain't the point. The point is that they've got this ruse that they use. Rather than trusting God, they use this ruse to try to remain safe amongst godless people. And what happened before happens again. Only this time the name ain't Pharaoh, it's Abimelech, the head of the Philistine, king of Gerar. Abimelech of Gerar sent and took Sarah. Well, surprise, surprise. Same thing that happened down in Egypt. Now, this is a 90-year-old woman. And I got to be real careful how I explain this. So you guys correct me now if I say something wrong. Sarah has been an outstanding looker her whole life. And she's being physically rejuvenated. Probably this 3-month interval between when the Lord first visited her and when Isaac was born, I suspect she could have sold a ton of beauty products. Because at age 90, she's looking like she's about maybe 50-ish, 60, something like that. She's looking much younger because she's being physically rejuvenated to bear this child in a normal physical birth and to nurse him afterwards. So all her body functions are going back to what they were when she was a younger woman. So she probably looks much younger than she is. And this Abimelech snatches her up in his harem. Now you know as well as I do what would normally happen in the course of time. She's in a harem. It's just a matter of time until she is defiled by this guy because of this ruse that they use, saying that she was a sister. So here at a time when her physical health and protection is sort of at utmost high, Abraham throws her out there where she gets snatched up by this guy and puts her health at risk. Remember what the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant were. There was going to be a seed among the other things, land, seed, and blessing. The seed was going to be Abraham and Sarah's seed. And it was going to be through that seed that God's blessing to his chosen people was going to come. What would have happened if Satan had managed to corrupt that line and had Abimelech to be the father of Isaac instead of Abraham? Kind of puts a whammy on the Abrahamic covenant, doesn't it? Kind of defiles the heck out of that. So you think there might be some satanic fingerprints on this incident? You think Satan is not trying to somehow or another disrupt the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant through Isaac and his parentage? He's probably grinning from ear to ear when he sees Abimelech snatch up Sarah into his covenant, into his harem. So what has to happen? God has to step into this situation just like he did in Egypt and correct it and undo the potential damage that these two have done. So he does. In verse 3, God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, "Behold, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she's married." So God steps in a situation that Abraham and Sarah have basically messed up. They've fuddled it all up. And he reveals to this guy, Abimelech, that he has taken a married woman into his harem. And he said, basically, "You're dead meat, guy." Now, Abimelech had not come near her yet. And he said back to the Lord, "Wilt thou slay a nation even though blameless?" Abimelech understood the threat from God to apply to his whole nation, that the whole nation was at risk here. And he says to God, "Well, will you wipe us all out over something that we didn't intend to do? We're blameless in this matter." Did he not himself say to me, "She's my sister"? That is, didn't this guy sort of lie to create the whole problem here, Abraham? And she added to it and said herself, "Yeah, he's my brother." So both of them are culpable in establishing the risk here to the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant, both Abraham and Sarah. "And in the integrity of my heart, in the innocence of my hands, I've done this." In other words, I didn't do this on purpose. I didn't know what was happening here. They both deceived me, and that's why this situation exists, Abimelech says. "Ain't my fault." And God says to him in that dream, yeah, I know that in the integrity of your heart, you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, Abimelech was right. He hasn't touched her, but it's because God prevented him from touching her. He has stepped into the situation to protect Sarah from possible defilement from this guy. Notice in verse 6 who the offense would be against here. Is it just Abraham? No, he says, I kept you from sinning against me. Adultery is ultimately a sin against God, not just the other marriage partner. It's a sin against God because the institution is God's, the institution of marriage. And so it would have been against him that the sin would have been focused. He says, therefore, I did not let you touch her. There was an act of grace going on in the background there that neither one of that Abimelech didn't know about, where God actually worked through circumstances to keep him from getting to her. They had not been able to come together physically in any way, and so that was the result of God's gracious hand. So now, therefore, he says, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. First use in Scripture of that word, prophet, right here. Don't normally think of Abraham as a prophet, do we? No, we think of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and all those guys. No, Abraham was a prophet also. That's just someone who speaks for God, represents God, and intermediates on behalf of man before God. So he says he's going to play that role for you and me, and he'll pray for you, and you will live. Intercession is one of the characteristics of prayer, isn't it? There's a number of them. Intercession is just one of them. Sometimes we intercede in prayer on behalf of others. Paul said, pray for all men. I want you to pray for, first he said for, I knew that was going to happen. He said, pray for all saints. And then he said, pray for all men. So he included everybody in intercessory prayer. So, yeah. Still hear me okay? We still on the air? Okay. One time I dropped that thing and it busted open and the batteries came out of it and, you know, everything just flew all over the place. At any rate, God offers that Abraham will intercede for them and he says, you'll live because of that intercession. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So they did have some little negative motivation there maybe to correct this situation, since God would wipe out the whole place, the whole nation, if they didn't. So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened. So he informs his household of what is actually taking place here. And it scared the daylights out of everybody that they could possibly be wiped out. So Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? How have I sinned against you that you've brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You've done things to me that ought not be done. Similarly to how Pharaoh responded to him 25 years earlier. Now things are not good when the godless of this world justly rebuke the godly. That ain't the way it's supposed to happen. The godless are not to be more noble in their behavior and more righteous than the godly. So this ought to be large alarms going off in the minds of both Abraham and Sarah that this is not right when these people, these kinds of people, are justly rebuking them. And they do. Do our sins always only affect us? Almost never do they only affect us. This guy's entire kingdom is at risk of destruction or for destruction because of Abraham and Sarah's sin. Adultery doesn't affect just one member of a marriage. Both members are affected, children are affected, extended families are affected, and on it goes. And so we need to recognize that our sins can splash over extended people. And it did here. So Abimelech goes on in his conversation with Abraham, verse 10, he says to him, well, what have you encountered that you've done this thing? And so Abraham gives him this lame excuse about how this sort of thinking has come about. He said, well, I thought sure there's no fear of God in this place, and he was right about that, and they'll kill me because of my wife. And he was probably right about that too, but he didn't say, well, I didn't trust God to protect me. I trusted myself and with this scheme that Sarah and I came up with. And besides that, she actually is my sister, which is a technicality here, as we talked about before. The daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is the kindness which you will show me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. So they've got this long-standing 25-year-old agreement that they would try to blow smoke at everybody they encountered concerning their relationship. So it's an old problem, a long-standing problem that just keeps rearing its ugly head. And do we not all have those kinds of things? These besetting sins, something that we just don't deal with, that just keeps coming back around from time to time, and this one did that for them. So Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants, and he gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. Now this is sort of a confusing factor here, isn't it? Because it looks like when you read this narrative that, hey, this plan worked great. I mean, this guy cleaned up. He got more animals. He's going to get some cash. Looks like this plan worked well. But it worked only because God intervened. Remember? God said, I didn't let you touch her. So don't misunderstand that because something ended well here that it was all well. It wasn't. But God superintended it and brought about a happy ending for them, even though they were the ones that were in the wrong. So Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please. Now remember, Pharaoh ran him off. He said, get the flip out of here. But Abimelech ain't Pharaoh. This ain't Egypt. This is a small little city-state of Philistines. And so Abraham probably had as much wealth and as big a household as Abimelech. So he probably wants him to have an association, wants him to be around. And that may also help to explain why he took Sarah into his harem. It may not have been quite the same physical attraction that she had the 25 years earlier down in Egypt. He may have said, hey, I want an association with this guy. If she's his sister, I'll just kind of take her as one of my wives and we'll be tight. And Abraham had a lot of wealth and so on. And so that may be part of the explanation there also. But he invites him to settle wherever he wants to. And to Sarah, he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men you are cleared. Cleared of what? Well, what do you think people thought when Sarah gets snatched up into this guy's harem? How about a month or two downstream when she is found to be with child? Who's the real father? Abraham or Abimelech? What are people going to think about her? This money, this gift here, is an attempt to, in essence, clear her of any misconception on the part of people as to who the actual father of Isaac is. It isn't Abimelech, and this gift is to, in effect, show that to mankind and to prove that to everybody that this is a sort of a testimony, in effect, that Abimelech was not Isaac's father. So people are going to wonder. They're going to see the timing of this situation. They're going to wonder, as I remember now, about the time she became pregnant, wasn't she in Abimelech's harem about that time? No, this is for that purpose of making sure that people don't misunderstand that. So Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Who controls the birthing process? Do you think God doesn't control it? Look at that verse right there. He had closed the wombs, closed them fast. There was no fertility going on in Abimelech's empire. God had stopped it. Remember, we've talked before how he has to be involved even before conception to assure the sex of the child that he wants born. Remember, we talked about those the 23 chromosomes that you get from your mom and from your dad, and the husband's got both male and female, chromosome number 23, and so God has to control that one to get the sex of the child that is to be born. So even before conception, God is active in the birthing process, and you can see here, he can shut that down totally if he wants to, and he did, and they weren't having any children in that household. Total impotence on the part of Abimelech and his household as judgment from God because of what had taken place. But he removed that when Abraham interceded in prayer for this family. So, what do we conclude from this experience? What in the world is going on here? Well, we mentioned already one of the things that we need to be sure and conclude, and that is the relentlessness of Satan's attempts to try to thwart the plan and purpose and will of God. Here he's trying to disrupt the Abrahamic covenant and the line of descent that is going to come forth from that covenant by trying to get Sarah impregnated by Abimelech and not Abraham. If he is relentless in his attempts to thwart God's purpose and plans, what should we be in trying to protect our own lives against those attacks? He doesn't take a nap. He doesn't sleep. He doesn't take vacation. He doesn't take any time off. He is always, always, always trying to hurt and harm our lives in some way. And especially anything that God has instituted, like marriage, we need to be very, 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 very careful about and constantly on guard against his attempts to defile it. Clearly, God protects his own. He stepped into this situation to protect Sarah from any possible harm. And I think it would have been helpful if they had actually sought God's counsel before going down here in the first place. Why is he down there? Did Satan entice him down there for some reason to move from here down to here where the danger was? Did Satan sucker him down there with some sort of plan to maybe make some money down there? I don't know what the thinking was. We're not told. But it looks like somehow or another now he's actively involved in that. So just be very, very careful. Guard your own life against his attempts to bring about some sort of harm to it. Okay, chapter 21. We actually get now the birth of Isaac here in chapter 21. Then the Lord took note of Sarah, verse 1 of 21, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. Well, in this particular case, God did what he said he was going to do. He fulfilled a promise that he'd made to Sarah earlier. Is that always the case? Yes, that's always the case. In hopes of eternal life, which God, who cannot lie, promised before the world began. That's Titus 1:2. God cannot lie. He cannot make a promise that he will not keep. He can't do that. So he not only is fulfilling this promise, he fulfills all promises that we have in Scripture. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. Just as he said before. And if we didn't know from the divine narrative here, we could be confused as to who the father might actually be. But we know because of what God has told us here. And people know because of the dowry in effect or whatever this payment type thing would be to Sarah that we saw take place there earlier. So 25 years after he was first promised a line of descent, he now has one in the form of Isaac, born to him by Sarah, his wife of 90 years, and he's 100. So the birth was unusual to say the least. Maybe miraculous, I don't know. Maybe it didn't quite go to that extent, I don't know. But certainly extraordinary to be sure. And Abraham circumcised his son. Whoops, let's see, verse 3. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. And remember what his name means? Laughter. Remember, they laughed at the idea that they were going to have a child in their old age. And so his name actually means laughter. He's an everyday reminder of the fact that God did exactly what he said he was going to do. And then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Remember that back in chapter 17, that was the symbol, the sign of belief in the Abrahamic covenant was this act of circumcision. The parents, of course, are the ones expressing the belief in the covenant, but they have their male children circumcised on when? Eighth day. Why? Did God tell them why? He said, do it on the eighth day. That's all you need to know. We know, or we think, now that perhaps that day was picked because of the coagulant in the blood, vitamin K, it's at its max in the human body on the eighth day of life. And so we think we know God used a medical reason there, but we don't need to know that. We just need to do what God said. And they did. He circumcised him on the eighth day. Remember that incident later on between Moses and his wife? When Moses had neglected to have his male child circumcised, they got in this this problem, and Moses almost was slain because of his neglect of that. So it's an important matter for the Jewish people that believe in the Abrahamic covenant to have their male children circumcised. So Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. He's 100, Sarah's 90. Now Sarah said, verse 6, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears me will laugh with me, concerning Isaac's name here. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Now she's going to be so physically regenerated that she can nurse her own child now at age 90. So all of those reproductive systems that have to get back working again, so she can produce mother's milk and the child can be nursed and all that stuff, all that happened. She got cranked back. It's like God set time back for her. Yet I've borne him a child in his old age. So Isaac was born naturally. Sarah was able to function like a younger woman with normal childbirth and the nursing of children and all that sort of thing. So all that was done by God. Pam and I were talking on the way down today that she could probably sold a lot of beauty products during that time frame, couldn't she? She could have put sand in a jar and probably sold it and said, look what it did for me. Can you do this? No, she would have made Cindy Crawford look like, well, I won't say it, but she wouldn't have looked as good as she does. But she didn't do that, I don't think. So the child grows in verse 8 and was weaned. What do you think, ladies? 2 years? 3 years? Weaning of children? 2 or 3 years, is that about right? I think maybe two in our society today, maybe a little longer back then, I don't know. But he grew, Isaac grew and was weaned. So this is now about two or three years later. And on that day, Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. So it's kind of a little celebration occasion for him, I guess. So he's like maybe, let's say three at most, maybe a little bit younger. I'm not sure exactly when he was weaned, but somewhere in that range. So they're having this feast and this occasion to celebrate this. And Sarah saw in verse 9 the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. So on this occasion of the weaning of Isaac, Sarah sees Ishmael mocking her child. Now Ishmael is about 15, maybe 16 at this point in time. He was born 12 years before Isaac, and then you have the weaning period of maybe another 3 years. So let's say he's mid-teen guy, okay, 15 years old. And he's mocking in some way. And Sarah is greatly offended. Verse 10, she says to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." Now, whatever this kid is doing, Sarah is very, very offended by it. Now, as we'll see this whole situation unfold here, it seems to be just one of harshness, unnecessary harshness, that's a little bit hard to understand. In the first place, this is a 15-year-old boy. Is there a bigger goofball on the planet than a 15-year-old boy? I don't think so. So you might cut the kid a little bit of slack in whatever he's doing here because he's a knucklehead. All 15-year-old boys are knuckleheads. So why would you take it quite so seriously unless it was just something that was extraordinarily offensive? Because he's just a teenage kid. But it does offend her, and offends her greatly. Now, she's been embittered toward Hagar for a long time. Remember, her idea of sending Hagar into Abraham to try to father a child through them, which was Ishmael, it was her idea. But once that idea blew up in her face, she was really not happy about that. So she's been embittered toward Hagar for some time, and she kind of lets her bitterness, it looks like, splash over onto Ishmael. Because she now goes to Abraham and says, "Get this guy out of here. Get this kid and his mother out of this household. I don't want him around my son at all." Now, these people have been a member of this family now for 25 years. And Sarah basically tells Abraham, "Get him out of here." 25-year member of the family, throw him out of here. I do not want him to be an heir with my son Isaac. I don't want him to share an heirship with Isaac. Now, we know that the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant will transfer down through Isaac and not Ishmael. There will come a separation of these two boys. We know that that's going to happen. And God is going to use this incident to bring that about. The thing that I'm just suggesting to you is that maybe it could have been done with a tad bit more grace than what we're seeing here. It's rather harsh that this 15-year-old kid who probably is just behaving like most normal 15-year-old kids is now being, in essence, disbarred from the family, along with his mother, because of something that he's done here. And Sarah's request to Abraham, verse 11, distressed him greatly because of his son. This is Abraham's son, Ishmael. And Sarah, his wife, has basically said to him, "Get him out of here. I don't want him around my son." And so Abraham now has to swallow real hard to do what Sarah has told him to do. off one of his son, run off his son, Ishmael. So God steps in. It's kind of like God stepping in and telling Joseph about Mary. God steps in to Abraham and says, look, don't be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be named. That is, he's saying in essence, go ahead and do this separation like she's saying. Now, he doesn't tell him to be quite so miserly about it, as we'll see, but the separation does need to take place. And he tells him that the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant will flow through Isaac, not Ishmael. That line. So the separation must come about, but it didn't have to be quite so harsh, as we'll see. And he says, and the son of the maid, I'll make a nation also because he's your descendant. I'm going to bless him with a long line of descent also because he's your son. So go ahead and make the separation like Sarah is suggesting there, and I'll take care of this boy. So Abraham rose early in the morning. Why do you think there was sort of a sense of urgency here to do this early in the morning? Remember, this guy's got a household of probably 1,000 people. We saw earlier evidence of that. Maybe he doesn't want this to be quite such a public spectacle that he's running off. He's sending away his own son. So I expect he tried to do it early in the morning before everybody was up and at it. And he took bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder. And he gave her the boy and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. A water jug and some bread. Remember, this guy is fabulously wealthy. He's got more stuff than you can count. And he sends Ishmael away with a bag of water and some bread. Can't spare a donkey? Can't spare 2 bags of water? 5 loaves of bread? Why does it have to be so meager? I wonder. And I don't know. I don't know the answer. I just get a bad taste in my mouth when I read this account because it is so miserly on the part of both Sarah and Abraham to send this boy and his mother away into a harsh environment with almost no provisions. There's a little bit there, not much. And you've got to wonder why. This guy's got so much. Why can't he give them some more to assure they can get somewhere? So I don't have an answer for it. I just don't like it. I don't see any grace being exuded here by either Abraham or Sarah. And it kind of bugs me a little bit. Because we see other character at times on the part of both of them that is admirable, but this is not. So they take off. She wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. That's down south here. They're down here. Here's Beersheba down here. This gets to be pretty deserty down here, the Negev area, all this stuff down here. Gets to be pretty harsh environment pretty quick. And lo and behold, the water in the skin was used up. Which, of course, it would be. Pretty short order. Apparently don't have much. So she puts him under some kind of a bush, apparently with a little shade. And she went and sat down opposite him about a bow shot away, 50 yards maybe, something like that. And she said, I don't want to see the boy die. And she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. All right, they've reached what they think is the end of their rope. She thinks they're about to die. She puts the kid underneath a bush for a little shade or something, and she goes over somewhere else because she doesn't want to watch her son die. Understandably so. So he's in one place, she's in another, and they think they're about to die from lack of water. And God heard the lad crying, And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What's the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is." Now, I don't know if Abraham told them that God had promised him that he would make a large line of descent through Ishmael or not. Abraham knows, but I don't know if he's communicated that to them or not. So they may not have any encouragement. They may not have any hope that God would do something, but God had told Abraham that he would. So he says, "Arise, lift up the lad and hold him by the hand. I'll make a great nation of him." So now he tells her that. She now knows it, perhaps for the first time. And God opened her eyes and saw, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. So again, God intervenes to fulfill the promise that he had made to Abraham concerning Ishmael and provides them with the water that they needed there. Apparently, she couldn't see it from where she was, or you know, I don't know if it was some sort of a mirage problem or what, but she now can. She can now see this well, and so she goes and gets some water and takes care of him. And God was with the lad, and he grew and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer. I guess that's how he was able to provide for himself and his mother. He became really good with a bow and arrow. He could harvest animals and do things like that to feed himself and his mother. And so that's the way he lived. And he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. The wilderness of Paran is down south here. See it down here at the very bottom? So he lived down here. It's where Ishmael and Hagar settled, and she took him a wife from Egypt, which was her home country. Now, on this chart, this is page 38 in your handout, you can see Ishmael's line coming down through here. He's right here. See him here? And then here's his 12 sons are mentioned in Genesis chapter 25. So, as God promised, he also was the progenitor of a large nation himself, Ishmael. It's just that the promises of the covenant come down through Isaac, and we'll see that as we go along. So he's not part of the Mosaic covenant. These guys here are not part of the provision of the Mosaic covenant. They get no land, seed, or blessings promised to them as Isaac and his descendants did. So this separation, which was a necessary thing, does indeed take place. It just takes place in a way that is a little hard to grasp and understand concerning the meagerness of the circumstances when you consider what Abraham had to work with. But at any rate, that's where it takes place, and they are now separated, and all of the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant will continue to flow, but through Isaac's line of descent, Ishmael is totally out of the picture. He doesn't get any of those promises fulfilled. God's people will not come from him, Ishmael. They will come from Isaac and only Isaac. Okay, now it came about at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham saying, "God is with you in all that you do." They recognize God's blessing on Abraham's life. And they said, "Now therefore swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my offspring or with my posterity, but according to the kindness that I've shown to you, you shall show to me and to the land in which you have sojourned." So the head of the Philistine nation there, Abimelech, these people over in this area here, he wants to enter into a covenant with Abraham and so that they get along okay. They don't end up fighting one another, deceiving one another anymore and all this kind of stuff. So he asks for Abraham to enter into this agreement with him. And Abraham said, verse 24, "I swear it." So he made a covenant with this Philistine king at this time. Is there any lingering consequences of this, do you think? Let me get this piece of paper off here. What area are they talking about here? Right there. What is that today? Is it Gaza Strip? Who's living there today? The Palestinians. And they've been a thorn in the side of the Israelis ever since. By the way, the name Palestine comes from the Philistines. That's a variation of the name Philistine. That's where that comes from. So this treaty has sort of had a lingering effect down through the years, and it still remains to this day sort of a thorn in their flesh. And the Philistines was a problem to David and Saul and all those guys down through time there. So this thing seems to have some lasting effect here. Verse 24, I swear it, Abraham said. And he uses occasion to complain about a well that they were sort of arguing over. Abraham complained to Abimelech because of a well of water which the servants of Abimelech had seized. Wells were very important, of course, to these people to water their animals with, and so they fight over them. And so Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this, neither did you tell me, nor did I hear it until this day. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Then Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves, and Abimelech said, Abraham, what do these seven lambs mean that you set by themselves? They said, you shall take these seven ewe lambs from my hand in order that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well. So I'm giving you this gift to attest to the fact that this is my well that your guys are bugging me over. And he said, you shall take these, therefore I called the place, therefore he called the place Beersheba, because the two of them made an oath there. Beersheba means well of the oath, or the seven animals that he gave him there. So it's kind of a indicates what's been going on here. So he made a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, arose and returned to the land of the Philistines. So Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. So he continues now to live down in this area, down south down here, or over in this area here. And it's worth noting that Isaac spent his entire life down there in southern Israel. He didn't wander out and go to Egypt like Abraham had, or anywhere else. He stayed there the entirety of his life down in this region, down in here. Okay, so what do we glean from this chapter then? What's been going on here that we can maybe learn something from? Well, first of all, we see the faithfulness of God to his promises, and that's a never-changing, ongoing fact, that God is faithful to his promises. He never does not fulfill a promise that he has made. I think we could probably conclude from what we saw earlier there that the lack of leadership in the home at times can be quite disruptive and so on, can't it? Abraham maybe could have stepped in and dealt with this problem between Ishmael and his mother, Hagar, and Sarah and Isaac with a little bit of kind of management there, some fatherly management, I think might have helped out in that situation, and kind of set some ground rules for how people are going to interact with one another and things of that sort. But we don't see any of that there. We don't see Abraham taking any role at all. He just does what Sarah told him to do and threw the kid out. The separation had to take place. That we know had to happen, but did it have to happen so harshly? Could Abraham not have managed that a little bit better as the head of that household? I think maybe he could have. And then lastly, we don't see hardly in any of this seeking God's will in where to go, where to live, how to do some of this stuff. It kind of creates a situation that God steps in and deals with, but doesn't seek his counsel beforehand in his travels or in some of his other things. And so knowing that Satan is at all times trying to hurt and harm us, doesn't it make sense to seek God's counsel on all matters of life? And we don't see a whole lot of that going on here, and it's kind of a mess as a result of it. Any questions or comments that you have this morning about these two chapters? We got Isaac on the scene now, and the narrative will proceed on now about him. He'll be the center of attention for the next chapter or two or three. We'll see him get a wife and do some other things. And so the flow of God's blessing down through the Abrahamic covenant will go through Isaac and his descendants, and we'll see that next. Abraham will sort of fade off the screen. Isaac will fade on in a little bit, not just yet, but we got a little bit to go yet. So questions or comments about anything in these two chapters, 20 and 21? Yes, Carol.
I'm just wondering, was Sarah with Abimelech more like weeks or months as opposed to days?
Probably.
You know, for this to be an issue.
Yeah, you got to be able to detect some impotency, and that ain't going to happen overnight. So you would think there might be a month or two maybe where people are saying, hey, all of a sudden we're not having any children in this household. Nobody's getting pregnant anymore. What's wrong? So I would think maybe a couple of months maybe would be reasonable to think, to see these signs. Because God had closed those wombs, and you wouldn't know that immediately. It would take a little while to know that. Any other questions or comments about anything? Going to rush out and buy some Sarah Beauty products now, ladies? Don't buy a jar of sand now. If they're telling you that's going to help, don't believe them. All right, we'll let you roll, and we'll see you next week, Lord willing. Have a good one.